Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. A few quick announcements. As I am going on spring break in the coming week, I am going to rerun one of our popular podcasts from years gone by. It will be David Wills on religious charity and taxes, just in time for the looming IRS deadline. So please check that out next week. Following that podcast, we're going to start moving our upload dates to Sundays, and that will be starting on April 14th. A number of you have asked that we start loading the podcast Sunday morning so that you can take them outside while you're doing yard work, bicycling around the neighborhood, or driving to grandmother's house, and we are happy to oblige that. With those announcements said, on with the show. If I said the phrase Islamic feminism to you, how would you react? If you are like me, you would tilt your head to one side, look quizzical, and give your best Scooby-Doo confused reaction. Raw? After all, any mention of Islam here in the West often conjures up images of burqa-clad women in Afghanistan, prohibitions against females driving in Middle Eastern nations, honor killings of girls who chose not to date according to their parents' wishes, and other patriarchal policies that have long since disappeared in Europe and North America. Indeed, if you had to pick a region of the world where women's rights were making little, if any, headway, it would probably be amongst Islamic-majority societies. So you can imagine my surprise when a copy of a book entitled Islamic Feminism in Kuwait, The Politics and Paradoxes, came across my desk a month ago. The author of that book, Dr. Alessandra Gonzalez, joins us today to talk about her work and her most recent trip back to Kuwait as a follow-up on her earlier research. Alessandra is a postdoctoral research associate at John Jay College at the City University of New York, a research fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the fine sponsors of this podcast, and a principal investigator of the Islamic Social Attitude Survey Project. As usual, you may find a link to Dr. Gonzalez's book and other related material on our website and additional information about upcoming events on our Facebook fan page. So please stop by and keep us company. Alessandra, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you for having me.
So Islamic feminism, of all the topics that I've covered on this program, this was probably one of the last ones that I thought I would be engaging in since I didn't really think the topic would be studied by anybody, but here we are. And your book is quite fascinating. I had a chance to look over it the past couple of weeks. I have to ask first off, though, how did you come to be intellectually engaged in this topic?
Yes, thank you, Tony, so much. And I'm honored that you'd have me on your program, especially since looking through your podcast, I noticed a lack of discussion about religion and feminism. So I'm clearly grateful for this opportunity to talk. And basically, I've been interested in the study of religion for a while, and I chose Baylor for graduate school specifically because they have a strong program in studying religion. So as I was looking for a dissertation topic, gender sort of came in as a secondary interest because I had a chance to travel to Kuwait for the first time in 2006. And women had just gotten the right to vote there in 2005. So whereas before, a topic that was somewhat taboo, women and political rights and Islam, actually was a topic everybody wanted to discuss. Then doing some research on the subject, I realized what a lack of actual intellectual study there had been from religious scholars about women as agents of social change. Usually there was a prejudice in the Western scholarship about women being inherently oppressed by Islam. And so I thought, let me just, you know, ask Muslim women themselves in a majority Muslim context if they agreed with that. So that's how it began.
Wow, pretty interesting. Now, had you had any previous experience in the Middle East, or just in 2006 you threw a dart at the map and said, oh, I'm going to Kuwait today?
Yes, actually, that's pretty much how it happened. I had the fortune of having some family connections travel to Kuwait, and so just as I started graduate school, I had a chance to visit them. And again, I like to be a little bit prepared, so before my trip, I did a little bit of research and found out what a dynamic situation was happening right around 2005, 2006, when I was about to take my first trip. So in a way, it was great for me to just kind of jump headlong into a discussion about Islam in the Middle East at that time, because I came in really open-minded. And then as I did continue my travels in the Middle East later on, I realized what actually a unique situation Kuwait had and what a perfect place to study this idea of feminism within Islam. Because Kuwait is situated actually right in an area between Saudi Arabia and Iran and next to Iraq. So it's actually at the center, epicenter of a lot of this discussion about Islam having Arab roots in the Arabian Peninsula, and also, you know, basically accepting a pluralism within Islam, which is part of its challenge, is just accepting the different versions and varieties of practice within Islam. So it became a good jumping off point.
Yeah, it seems that there's a great deal of fortuitous opportunity that was available to you there. And one of the great things about scholarship is that if you're well trained, and your book shows that you very much are well trained in graduate school, Baylor's a great place to go. When these opportunities appear to you, you just grab them right away, and you're always looking for new things to study. So again, very fortuitous, but also a lot of great preparation there.
That's right.
Now, one of the first things you lead off with in your book, it's actually in the first chapter, is a very simple question of what exactly do we mean by Islamic feminism? And I'm sure that many of our listeners are wondering the same thing. But before taking up that topic of Islamic feminism, it might be worthwhile to get a little bit of clarification on what we mean by feminism more generally. You were correct to note that we don't have many podcasts on religion and feminism within our archives, in part because it's not a topic that I'm very familiar with, but I am branching out. So tell us a little bit about what feminism is. I'm sure that's a very contested term that's up for a lot of multiple interpretations. So as we dig into your study, how are we supposed to understand this concept of feminism? Are there multiple understandings of that concept? And how do you define and use that term?
Actually, I think most of the women and men that I interviewed would not identify themselves as feminists or Islamic feminists, because the term is so loaded, as you pointed out. It has a lot of different interpretations, but probably most commonly, the term feminism is understood as what gender scholars like to identify as second wave feminism. So a lot of times scholars that look at feminism as the social change movement kind of divided up into several waves. So the first wave within U.S. And European feminism is sort of a push for women's suffrage. So just entering the political arena as political actors, a lot of times that accompanied social issues of the day at the late turn of the late 19th and beginning of early 20th century. So sometimes that accompanied abolition movements or temperance movements or movements of charity trying to bring attention to causes of the poor. So actually very different than the sort of feminism that we associate with the feminism of the 1960s and 70s, which is, again, probably the most commonly associated movement with this term feminism.
And that would be second wave feminism in the 60s
right.
and 70s.
Second
okay.
wave feminism from the 60s and 70s that pushed women's equality in more detail, actually, you know, requiring women to be recognized as capable leaders in every field of business and education. And it also accompanied unique social changes within the U.S. in terms of civil rights for racial minorities and other actors that were previously marginalized in U.S. public life. So, and then from there we see a third wave feminism where an individuality from basically the 90s, late 80s, 90s, encouraged women to share their stories, including women of the Middle East or women from other cultural backgrounds, to share their voices in sort of a post-colonial postmodern milieu. And now we're in something that nobody has really defined yet. Basically, just a postmodern era where we have technology shaping a lot of our connections to other groups and other world views. And so I think this phenomenon of Islamic feminism, its term is something I think best uses academically, because not many people walk around calling themselves Islamic feminists, and yet they're pushing for women's equality within their own cultural framework, which is something new that perhaps this Western feminism that I draw attention to in the book and say that Western feminism has not reached hearts and minds of Arab Muslim majority populations is because it's so associated with kind of almost this dominant discourse saying your feminism has to look like ours, unveiled and sexually liberated, and in many ways that isn't consistent with the values that what I found these Islamic feminists want for themselves.
And that makes the study very interesting, again, because a lot of us are going to read this through the eyes of Westerners and look at the struggle for women's equality and women's rights in a number of these countries, and it just will seem to be a hard circle to square for many of us. So it's
right.
A neat interesting challenge, and that's what you mentioned, the paradoxes in the title of your book as well. Now, I have to go back. You just mentioned that we're living in the post-postmodern era.
Well, again, these are terms that academics like to throw around because we're not sure of yet to the extent of the change that we're seeing through social media, the change that we're seeing through greater access to higher education, and the shift in economic power, basically maybe new powers in the global stage emerging from other centers, you know, in the East, challenging U.S. European economic dominance. These are going to challenge our understandings of who's trying to model who. So it's no longer the case that women in the Middle East look to European and American feminists and say we want to be just like them. Actually, there's many that say, you know, this is a time for us to own our own culture and identity and find a way to fight for our rights from within our own worldview, and we see this in the recent social movements happening in the Middle East.
Okay, I was just worried that we're running out of the word post, because we'll soon be in the post.
The post times three.
Yeah, and I still think I'm stuck back in the modern era, or maybe
right.
even pre-modern, because I still have difficulty using my smartphone. So anyways, let's talk about Kuwait for a minute. And
sure.
You told us earlier on why you chose that. Again, it was part a fortuitous coincidence that you had some relatives living there, but then you started doing a little research and say, wow, this is going to be a great topic. It's at the epicenter of a lot of changes that are occurring in the Middle East, as you mentioned. Could you set the socio-political table for us so that we can understand how women's rights are taking shape in this country? But we need to know a little bit about the country before. Now, you talk about a couple different groups within Kuwait society that are emerging in addition to Islamic feminists. So in order to understand the position that the Islamic feminists are in, it might be worthwhile to understand this broader cultural context. You're mostly talking about Islamists here and liberals. Who are these folks?
Well, part of the reason that this study is about Islamic feminism in Kuwait specifically and not Islamic feminism with a broad brush is because of the importance of looking at cultural context when kind of approaching this idea of religion and gender and their intersection. Also because it does help shape a little bit of the exceptionalism of the situation of women in Kuwait. Women in Kuwait have had access to university education since the 60s, which makes Kuwait actually a real shining star among the countries in the Arabian Peninsula because they had this door open to women, which is interesting because they didn't get the right to vote until 2005 in many ways. You know, it is kind of paradoxical that women would have access to higher education and yet not be permitted to have this to exercise their political rights until so late. But again, we're looking from this vantage point where the U.S. has had its independence since 1776, and Kuwait has had its independence since 1961. So actually a lot of social change has happened for countries in the Middle East, but in Kuwait I can speak specifically because before their independence, they actually had a lot of interaction with the British and other colonial powers, and helped them through their discovery of oil and natural resources, set out a trajectory for their economy, which just exploded the social change there. So after a 20th century discovery of oil and an independence from the British in 1961, we saw a lot of social change occurring, which interestingly did not occur in a vacuum. We had a lot of change in the broader Middle East. There were voices saying that Arab countries should come together in a pan-Arab political way, which, and interestingly enough, was the vision that that Muhammad had when he called a lot of tribes in Arabia to come together under this banner of Islam. He tried to break down some of the tribal barriers and said, let's come together through our faith in God. And through that vision, he tried to unite a lot of countries. Now, fast forwarding to the 1960s, we have people like Nasser in Egypt, and he's trying to basically say, we can have a secular version of this united around our Arab identity and brotherhood, which for several reasons, especially instances of, for example, the Iran and the Iraq war, just regional disputes started puncturing this idealized vision for countries to come together around an Arab nationalism. So you had that on top of a failure of Arab nationalism project, along with the success, you could say, of the Iranian Revolution in 1979. So you have competing visions of what it means to be a majority Muslim country in the Middle East. You have the Iranian version, which is saying we want a theocracy, which prioritizes religious authorities and equates, or actually puts, the religious Sharia, the law, the religious law, above any kind of secular constitution. So in this milieu, Kuwait is having to respond and actually state claims about their own identity. So Kuwait's constitution, interestingly, has a very unique balance by saying that in their constitution, the Sharia is one of the sources of legislation. So it's not the source of legislation, it's one of the sources of legislation. So Kuwait can basically adapt and reinterpret kind of article and the definitions in its constitution to meet modern challenges, which is unique because it does basically give it this three-legged stool of legitimate authorities, which I sort of structure in the book as a theoretical framework to understand this phenomenon of Islamic feminism, which means the religious authority and the political authority and a community authority where people vote and they express their will through a constitutional democratic means are actually held in some sort of tension. I can't say equality because it actually has provisions for the ruling emir to be above reproach, above criticism, so he actually has a lot more veto power than the parliament does, or even the religious establishment. So it's not an exact three branches of government that have equal power, but they have a tension that keeps them in dialogue and discussion, which is very unique. It's very unique in the Gulf.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so that... we come with this milieu, all this tension, and the Iraqi invasion of 1990 challenged again Kuwait's independence. Having overcome this the surprise invasion, women entering basically a new, saw themselves entering a new space, because they didn't just sit at home and kind of wait for bombs to fall on them. They actually joined the war effort. They found, and fought bravely in many respects, trying to help with the war effort. So after the war, both women activists from Islamic backgrounds and secular backgrounds decided, we want to actually retain this role that we have to fight for our country.
Let me ask you about that. I mean, we talked about the right to vote here a second, but you mentioned that women joined the war effort against Iraq. How so? Were they frontline troops? Were they behind the line serving in other capacity? How did this change? Again, because I'm interested in this because in the West, World War II was a very important fulcrum point for women's rights and how that changed their relationship to the economy. So tell us a little bit more about that. That's interesting.
Yes. Well, similarly, I think I'm not sure if I spent time on it, but I would definitely draw parallels between women entering the war effort in World War II, mostly behind the scenes, meaning not at the front lines, because first of all, you know, the Kuwaiti armed forces, you know, in general, they basically just besides the cultural conservatism, there wasn't the kind of training of women to capacitate them to be at the front lines, but they helped. You know, retain our artillery, shelter the wounded, actually basically caring for people as they got injured and hiding out and basically trying to help restructure whatever possible areas in the country were not under attack to help fortify those areas. So, I mean, some women went further and they helped, they were engineers and they helped use their expertise, but it wasn't a very drawn out war, and so you would say the opportunities that they had were kind of short to exercise whatever strengths and abilities they had, but they didn't just sit back at home. They actually saw themselves as needing to participate, which, you know, they basically it helped them see themselves in a new role. Not that they were silent before, but it helped give men also the opportunity to see women as equal partners.
Mm-hmm.
So it made sense after that. And even the parliament and even the ruling emir started having discussions about, well, you know, women were essential when our country was under attack. We need to respect their political agency. So why not consider their right to vote and run for office? So actually the motion to have women become candidates for political office and have the right to vote came up in the 90s, in 1998, but actually was voted down by the all-male parliament, which included liberals and Islamists. And so many women pointed to this failure of the political liberals to actually step in and vote for women's right to vote in a majority.
Okay, so you just mentioned two other groups within society, and I think these groups are important to highlight here. They're ones that caught my attention because, again, this is we're fighting a battle about how to redefine rights within a society, and there are mm-hmm. two other ideological or, I guess, theological positions. You mentioned the Islamists and the liberals. Who are those folks?
Well, this is inching closer to my definition of Islamic feminism. So by liberal, I kind of took the indigenous term from what I heard people explaining to me in my interviews, which basically means secular, a belief that religion and politics should remain separate. So a lot of times the point of reference does go back to this pan-Arab nationalism that basically tries to overcome sectarian differences by just leaving religion separate from politics. And then by conservative or Islamist, political Islamist, this means someone who considers their Islamic beliefs and traditions important enough to direct politics and somewhat aligns themselves with the belief that Sharia should be equal to or above, in fact, the Constitution. So both of these are actually the extreme ends of what you see in the majority of Kuwait society. Women are have the freedom to choose whether or not they do want to wear the veil. So that alludes back to the point I said about the Sharia, the Islamic law, being one of the sources of legislation. So if it was a source of the only source of legislation, like in Iran or Saudi Arabia, it's possible that the religious authorities would legislate something like women's dress. But in Kuwait, since it's only one of the sources of legislation, the Islamists have to fight for their political space along with the liberals and along with those independents or moderates in between.
Mm-hmm. So I can see how the liberals and the Islamists would be a part of these, the three-pronged or three-legged parts of the stool that the liberals would be facing or fighting for more parliamentary forms of democracy, whereas
exactly.
Islamists favor Sharia. You did a nice job of explaining to us how women's role has advanced. One of the things that you mentioned earlier was the role of women's education, that they had the opportunity to early on, at least compared to other countries within the region, to go on to higher education starting in the mid-1960s or so. Has that had an impact on how women are entering the economy and are rethinking their roles in society? Do we see an increasing number of women in white-collar jobs, in service sector industries such as insurance? And because one of the things that I've noticed, again, thinking about American history, is that as educational opportunities opened for women, they were able to take advantage of some of the comparative advantages they have in intellectual power. And as the economy moved toward a more service-oriented economy as compared to or away from a manufacturing economy, they became much more powerful. They gained more bargaining leverage in that. Is something like that happening in Kuwait?
Yes, absolutely. And actually, it's a phenomenon that's happening throughout the Gulf now, throughout the Arab Peninsula. And I'm glad you pointed this out because, again, it's something that I wanted to highlight in my book. For a lot of Western audiences, the fact that women are gaining more and more opportunities in terms of education and in terms of public life, and yet they're choosing to wear the veil, seems somehow to be a roadblock to understanding what's going on in the Middle East. And from the other side, my colleagues in Kuwait and a lot of times in my travels throughout the Middle East, they would say, why is this piece of cloth, this veil that covers our hair, the main thing that people see when they look at Arab Muslim women? And they, you know, they feel that there are voices and things that women are achieving that don't get heard because of this obsessive focus from the West on whether or not they're liberated because of the way that they dress. So it's interesting that since women in Kuwait have had the right to access education since the 60s, a lot of changes have happened to draw women from more marginalized backgrounds, that means rural or Bedouin ancestry, into university education. And so you see demographic changes bringing women into university, that also provides basically just an extra layer of interesting dynamics to this discussion we're having about the importance of feminism within a culturally conservative environment. One of the first publications I had through this Islamic Social Attitude Survey data I published in the Journal for the Scientific Study of Religion, one of the findings from this pilot study of Kuwaiti college students was the young men in university whose mothers had at least some education were more likely to consider themselves believers in gender equality or what I'm discussing as Islamic feminists.
Mm-hmm.
So there was an actual statistical link between boys whose mothers had at least some college education. Maybe they weren't the CEO of a company, maybe they hadn't run for office or even exercised the right to vote, but they had opened up at least a new generation of men, young men's ideas about what women are capable of and still remain true to their Islamic values. So I think just access to education is something that has become a real value, is seen as something of value, not just by outsiders or even administrators of education in the Middle East, but even this new young generation that sees itself not sort of caught between an old mentality, a tradition, and this reality of modern connectivity through technology and through their own experiences.
That's interesting. This definitely is a generational issue, and that's, you have a chapter in your book near the end about how the younger generation is viewing this. I want to boomerang that with something that you mentioned earlier about the veil.
Sure.
And this is something that I have noticed on our campus here at the University of Washington as well, is that we have a number of students from the Middle East, and I've been there for 20 years, and it's been increasingly obvious that more and more women from Middle Eastern countries are wearing the veil or the hijab. Now, is when we talk about veil and hijab, are those the same things?
Yes, in this discussion it is, yes, just covering the hair.
Okay, and I've seen that more and more. I would say if I went back 15 or 20 years ago, I didn't see anybody wearing it. But nowadays you see a lot of young females wearing the hijab, wearing the veil. Is that something that we're also seeing in Kuwait as well? Is there something about the culture that's changing that younger people are accepting this?
Yes. No, that's a great observation. And there's definitely a generational aspect to this discussion about the increasing presence of the veil. In fact, in one of my chapters, I talk about how in the 60s and 70s in Kuwait, it was very popular for women, especially of higher elite, wealthy social backgrounds entering university to not wear the veil. And so one of the women I interviewed was a pioneer in this approach that I'm calling Islamic feminism, because she chose to wear the veil at university when it wasn't popular in the 70s. And so she kind of was projecting that in the future there's going to be a choice almost made of between women who are going to throw off all of their cultural Islamic heritage in order to bargain for modern, what they might perceive as Western rights of asserting their independence in the public sphere, and then others who would respond to maybe failures and critiques of the Western version of feminism by taking on their veils and saying, we can have certain benefits of Western feminism without throwing off all of our cultural identity. And I think since 9/11, which is actually another section in the book that I just bring out, I think a lot of majority Muslim societies have felt the need to define themselves apart from this global war on terror, because it's unfair in many ways that Islam has come under research of, you know, study and focus and as a subject of study because of just the confusion that Westerners had after 9/11 about Islamic jihadism and these extremists that were willing to kill innocent people in the name of their faith. And so a lot of majority Muslim countries needed to distinguish themselves from this kind of abhorrent, violent, extremist interpretation by saying, look, you know, we're good Muslims, and this isn't at all a part of our belief system. And so I think a lot of young people are also responding in similar ways, saying we don't want all the disappointments that maybe even Western feminists admit they have experienced through complete liberation, complete calls for equality. And that's the appeal, actually, of political Islamists, not confusing Islamic feminists with Islamist feminists, which Islamists, political Islamists, who again, they try to join their belief system with their politics, constantly are pointing out the disappointments that Western feminists have seen and felt by basically calling on women to be everything that they should be because doors have opened to them, and still feeling fulfilled in their personal life as mothers, as in the home. And so it's almost calling for a supernatural woman to fulfill all the possible doors that have opened to Western feminists. So political Islamists say, we're not going to put this kind of pressure on women by saying because doors have opened to you, you need to, you know, fulfill all of your duties at home and be completely up to par in the public as we hold men accountable. So there's a lot that young people are responding to, saying, yes, you know, there are a lot of failures in Western feminism and objectivism, an objectification of women's bodies that in taking on the veil they're responding to by saying modesty is cool, modesty is valuable, and modesty helps create the kind of societies that we want to retain for our children. And so there's a lot that's said by taking on the veil, and yet when I surveyed the young women at Kuwait University, the majority of them said that they chose to wear the veil for their personal faith. So again, it speaks to this interesting gap in the research on Islamic religiosity that assumes that as a communal religion, Islam doesn't have variation by individual experience or religiosity at an individual level is somehow not worthy of study. But I found in my study that young people do internalize and have private religious experiences, and taking on the veil can be one of those things. And I think in the West, maybe at UW or some other college campuses, as women from Muslim backgrounds decide, as many of us do in college, what are the things that matter to us, what do we stand for, they're choosing out of their personal faith to make this visible statement by wearing the veil.
Yeah, that is very interesting. In my own experience with a number of these students and with some friends of mine as well, is that you see a woman with a veil and you say, oh, our idea is that this is a weak and timid person oppressed by a patriarchal society. But you find out as you discuss with them that they're very strong. They're very clear about why they want to wear it. And it's a very personal choice that they make. They take ownership over it. It might now be good to talk about this issue of Islamic feminism, now that we've laid out the context and talked about some of the issues that's affecting Kuwait and women throughout the Middle East. And what do you mean by Islamic feminist? You say this isn't a term that not many people in Kuwait use for themselves, but it is a term that you titled your book. So let's go ahead and define what you mean by Islamic feminism and what the characteristics of it are.
Sure. In short, what I mean by Islamic feminism is a movement that seeks to further a progressive agenda for women's rights within an Islamic framework. So actually, there's a lot of room for negotiation here, because I don't mean just women can be Islamic feminists. I mean men can also fight for women's rights within an Islamic framework. And it also means you don't have to be an Islamist feminist, meaning you don't have to believe in the Sharia overruling a constitution to still fight for feminism within an Islamic framework. So in a way, the actual work, this term comes out of the actual work that I've seen women and men looking, accomplishing in Kuwait as a way for us to understand broader intersections of religion and gender in an academic sense. That are lacking in the academic literature. So you know, there's basically two important aspects to this term: is the academic usage that we can use, and I hope that those teaching classes are interested in for their own research in this intersection between religion and gender will take a look at my study, because it's a perfect intersection of where you have ideas about where religion limits women and progressive rights for women, and it also points out the blind spots where a lot of women's rights activists have disregarded religious voices as actors that they can partner with in terms of certain specific social goals. So when I look at Islamic feminism in Kuwait, some of the distinctions that I find is, regardless of the terminology they use, in their activism, they include their feminism as part of a comprehensive Islamic worldview. And actually, in response to my book, some of the faculty at the university where I did my study were just pointing out, you know, all of Kuwait is Islamic and traditional. So there's hardly anyone that would not call themselves a practicing, believing Muslim and actually have respect for all the traditions that are kind of enrobed in that, and so it does affect the way that we analyze religion, Islamic religiosity, to understand this gender component. And it also is a matter of looking at the importance of religiosity and religion's influence in gender studies in majority Muslim countries. So there is this importance of a comprehensive Islamic worldview. Also, that their activism, whether they consider themselves politically secular or politically Islamist, is legitimated in their societies by some sort of religious source, a sacred text or tradition, and also that there's a cultural compatibility with what they're doing. And the young people were constantly asserting this, you know, and whatever they were kind of finding a reason to be disgruntled about, they would say, you know, it's not Kuwaiti, or it's not a good, you know, a good Muslim thing to see this injustice, whatever the issue was in particular that they were discussing. So they would talk about their activism as being consistent with their culture, and with their faith system.
Explain that a little bit more, because that was one of the parts of the book that I had to wrestle with a bit, because again, as you mentioned, younger people are adapting this, and younger people always love to change the culture, and right. You know, they're new and vibrant and stuff, yet they're seeking this cultural compatibility, whether it be with Kuwaiti Arab society or with their religion. How is it? It seems like almost a neo-traditionalism that they're embracing at this moment.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to put it. The way that a colleague and mentor of mine at the university and I published a paper basically discussing this, where scholars like Hunter and Huntington, they talked about some kind of clash that would happen with modern Western individual values and an Islamic worldview. But instead of a clash, we found a coexistence among young people. They would say, I'm both a good Muslim, a good practicing Muslim, and I believe in gender equality, and I would consider myself, you know, a fighter for women's rights within Islamic worldview. So there was some kind of coexistence between these extremes, as I mentioned, reflected in politics between the secular liberals and the political Islamists. So they represent what I call a third way. And actually, one of my interviewees brought it up as such. He said, you know, we represent the third way between political Islamism and liberal secularism. So some of the cultural compatibilities that they're not willing to let go are these ideas that even though they have access to the internet and it has global implications for them to see themselves connected to communities beyond Kuwait, for example, they also are they build their identity around the local community and the family structure that they're a part of. So there are what is still recognized as tribal influences, where an extended family and kinship structure does influence how people see themselves politically and in terms of practicing their religion. So someone from a very secular kind of background is going to have a hard time basically becoming a political Islamist because there's just a pressure against it. And yet they're pushing these boundaries. So if they come from a secular background and they want to be more religious and politically involved, then there's really nothing stopping them. So in a way, they are pushing boundaries, as you said, by just challenging norms from whatever background they come from. And the same, I'm sure, with a lot of maybe more rural girls and boys who have access to university. Their parents allow them to come to university, so they may wear even a face veil because they feel that, you know, they're already pushing the backgrounds from their family to attend university. So wearing the veil but getting to come to university is an unfair trade-off in their mind. So in those ways, you might call them compromises to push boundaries, and yet they are respectful of those boundaries because they don't, you know, they want to kind of bring their families along with them in this process.
And that's very interesting, because you make another statement too in the chapter that you really outlined what Islamic feminism is all about by saying that Islamic feminists are not resisting patriarchal structures, but rather embracing them. What does that mean? Is that part of going along with, I want to bring my family in this process? It's not a complete break with the past, but there's some cultural continuity?
Yes. Well, one of the best ways that I heard this explained, this idea of embracing patriarchy, was a woman who ran for political office, and she came herself from a very rural Bedouin background. So for her to just come in public and campaign in front of strangers and strange men was already a big ruckus. But then that her husband was supporting her and actually helping her in campaign, supporting her morally and attending her speeches was just a complete cultural kind of upset. But she said, you know, I basically believe, you know, that it's important to fight injustice in my community, and I know that I can't do it without the support of my family. And in fact, this is reflected in my political agenda that Kuwait is like a family, and we need men and women to work together. So, you know, she invited me into her home and said, you've seen how my house works, and Kuwait is like our big house. And if we don't have men and women working together, it's really going to fall apart. And in a country where family is completely at the backbone of the society and people feel very loyal to their families, this is a great analogy for this idea of feminism within Islam. It's saying within the fold, within our family, we're going to bring people along with these new ideas and show them that within our faith, we can't just sit back and allow things to be done in the name of our faith that are really not Islamic, allowing women to, suffer in whatever kind of abusive situations. It's not good for the men and or the women. And a lot of men who I dedicate a whole chapter to are actually enabling this women's activism. And in fact, in many women's movements you can see throughout history, unless there were men enabling strong women, a lot of times the doors just wouldn't have been open to them. So there is an importance to recognize the role that men are playing in enabling a feminism within Islam in majority Muslim countries, because they are not only usually the ruling authorities in the religious establishment and the political establishment, but in the community. So they're the local, basically, chief kind of leaders that people look up to and ask for advice. And so without their consent, a lot of times, nothing gets done. No man can get anything done. So sometimes when they take a strong woman under their wing and they allow them the space to become leaders and to train other women, it just really skyrockets their potential, not just in the private sphere, but again, I highlight a lot of these really amazing men who are encouraging women in the public sphere.
This brings up an interesting question for me as well as I'm reading through your book. The women's right movement here in the United States and places like Europe is oftentimes associated with some very charismatic figures. Gloria Steinem comes to mind. Is there that kind of leadership, certain individuals that are really taking the lead in Kuwait to push the Islamic feminist agenda? Or is it more of a grassroots movement? From what I read in your book, it seemed to me that it was more bubbling up from below, and there weren't necessarily any specific leaders, but it's just a new cultural milieu that is arising.
Absolutely. Yes, I would say it is more of a grassroots kind of movement. I mean, there are definitely women who stand out, but I even, just chose to highlight their activism and not their names or voices because they don't. They are working in ways that don't make them personality cults. And in a way, this is what makes them so powerful, because they're trying to focus on movements by mentoring other young women, whether it's through the women's societies. And again, these can be secular ones that incorporate Islamist women into the fold, or as I highlight in the book, some young Islamists, political women who get together after work and outside of class and try to basically coalesce their political agendas and come up to parliamentarians' offices and give them a laundry list of suggestions for bills. So these are active women who work in groups because they know that in unity, in numbers, they're going to have a lot more power. And in a way, that makes them a force to challenge with than just bringing cults of personality down, which is, it makes it harder for any women running for political office, because oftentimes that's, as pioneers of women entering politics, it has to become somewhat of a personality that they're running on, and it's not always successful if they try to run by themselves.
Yeah, there's you need that name recognition, but yet this is a movement that's occurring amongst a wide swath of society that's not necessarily associated with one particular person. Let me ask you about the way you went about this study, because I'm somewhat fascinated about this. You have a quantitative part of the study where you've relied upon survey data that you collected, and you also have a qualitative aspect of it where you went and talked to a number of important women and important men within this movement. And how was that for you? Because as I understand it, you're not Muslim, is that correct? And, you know, you have a name, Gonzalez, that is not Arabic either. And I've had the same issue when I've done research in Latin America. You know, you go down there and they say, oh, you're somebody else. And you always wonder, are people behaving differently around you when you're there talking to them and possibly giving the answers that you want to hear? How did you go about doing this qualitative research, and did you have some difficulties in trying to open doors, and how did you overcome those difficulties?
Well, first off, I have to give all the credit to my local advisors at the university where I work, because I came in and I had this idea for a dissertation project, and a number of people said, oh, there are a number of professors that would be very interested in helping you with your project. Why don't you go and talk to them? And a number of them took me under their wing and said, you know, we really think what you're doing, the approach that you're taking has a contribution to make, and we want to help you. So that opened all the doors that I needed, especially in a kind of a society like Kuwait, where your reputation and the names you're associated with really matter. So to be linked with some, and also be under the mentorship of local advisors, made all the difference. So that was my jumping off point. And in fact, in my recent trip to Kuwait, I'm just very proud that at Kuwait University, they've opened one of my mentors there has opened a center for women's research study. So this is an area of study that is just going to continue to blossom. And Kuwait, because of just, again, its openness to the value of education and scientific research, is going to be, I think, at the center of studies of women's achievements in the region, not seeing them as blinded by their religious conservatism, but actually documenting and highlighting the areas where they're achieving, and they can provide a critique to Western gender studies. So I'm really happy about that. So a combination of good mentors, and then also just the sociological approach, which is to minimize social location, was a key component, I think, to my research success. So I knew coming into the study that I would just be preaching to the choir if I only spoke to liberal women's rights activists who were unveiled and who would, again, just agree with me that it's very difficult to have any change happen in very traditional conservative societies. So I really saw it as a sociologist of religion to try to understand the religious voices within this approach for women's suffrage in Kuwait. And so I wanted to speak with Salafi parliamentarians, who are known to be the most conservative religious scholars, who fought hard against women's right to vote, because in their interpretation of the Islamic law, they saw that this would be basically against women's interests to have them enter politics. And even if I didn't understand where they were coming from, I really wanted to know. So I think just presenting myself as someone objective who really wanted to understand helped open a lot of doors. And in a way, it showed me the kinds of mutual obstacles that I think a lot of Middle Eastern Muslim scholars have about working with Westerners, that we come in usually with an agenda that we want to push. And I basically realized from my training as a sociologist that I didn't have really an agenda. I mean, I had an idea of what I wanted to understand, but I really wanted to listen to the voices of the most conservative, along with the moderates and the liberals, to just get a wider picture. In a way, as an outsider, someone who wasn't from the culture, it didn't really matter that I wasn't a Muslim, but that I was respectful of their religious belief system and tradition, and especially having grown up in a conservative Christian environment in Texas, I understood the belief and the importance that people's beliefs have incorporating their religious worldview into their politics. So I had no, you know, trouble actually approaching them. But also getting to build trust, as you know found in your own travels, is a matter of just being consistent and saying, basically asking the same questions to the conservatives as the liberals, and just giving them time if they would be willing to meet with me, and hopefully, you know, representing their perspectives accurately in my published work. So I hope that, you know, people will look at this study and find it kind of just, you know, an example of where if they are willing to listen, you know, they might learn something new. And I found that also in my interview subjects who were shocked and amazed and surprised that they would meet a Western researcher interested in talking about women's issues that wasn't pushing their own agenda, mm-hmm. and, you know, and had a respect for their value system. So
did you wear a hijab? Did you wear a hijab when you did interviews?
Not in Kuwait. I didn't wear a hijab in Kuwait because, again, you know, they've had interactions with Westerners for a long time. And it actually was an interesting persona to be, someone who is, you know, a young person, but a Westerner and a woman. So it gave me, in some ways, access to interview men because they saw me as a Westerner, somebody, you know, who is scientifically minded that they could have a serious conversation with. And then, of course, it gave me access to women being a woman and being sensitive to their issues. It was a perfect, you know, situation for me to enter, and I felt really fortunate. Those are things that you can't always replicate. Like, I couldn't pursue some areas of study, for example, that were maybe more important to studying men's issues because that wasn't always a space that I could close completely in terms of social location.
Explain what you mean by that, minimizing social location. You mentioned that a little bit earlier, and that sounds a little bit of a social science jargony term here. And
sure.
It's, I think you sociologists use that more than us political scientists. So explain what that is.
Sure. Well, okay. So where basically it means meeting people where they're at. So I knew doing, you know, my research ahead of time, whoever I was meeting with, what kind of background they came from, if they were more conservative, if they were more liberal. I tried to be basically pretty neutral in my dress. I just wore a black suit all the time and was very modest. And I followed the local rules, and Kuwait has the prohibitions against pork and against alcohol, and I knew enough about Islam to respect, you know, again, a lot of their traditions. I have a couple instances in the book where I had to just learn by trial and error.
Mm-hmm.
Some people, you know, have even stricter personal moral rules for themselves, so, you know, I approached one male interviewee. He was very open, very, you know, he'd studied in the U.S. He got his PhD in the U.S. He had an American accent when he was speaking in perfect English with me. So as I went to introduce myself, I extended my hand to shake hands because it just seemed so natural. And so, I mean, it didn't matter that he had a short, trim beard and that he was wearing the local dress. I just, you know, I was just instantly, you know, felt the kinship there. And, of course, he had to be polite and say, "I'm sorry, I don't shake hands. Please have a seat." And so, of course, I was mortified because I was trying to approach, you know, close this social location, trying to meet him where he's at, and, you know, I'd made a big faux pas. So I learned, you know, from that experience. Another one was funny because it was my first interview with an Islamist woman. So one woman who clearly aligned herself with just, you know, against a Western view of feminism, just basically saying there's a lot of critiques that we have about Western approaches to feminism, and I was afraid that I would be somehow encapsulating this Western feminism she was fighting against as a Western woman. So when I went to meet her, I was just, you know, trying to be as ingratiating as I could, and I had made a habit of bringing a little sort of sweet chocolate treat to my guests to basically mm-hmm. break the ice.
Right,
I got her a little bag of chocolates and said, you know, "Well, it's so nice to meet you, madam, and I hope, you know, that you enjoy these chocolates. What woman doesn't like chocolate?" Basically trying to just close my social space. And she said, "Oh, thank you, but I'm diabetic."
Oh.
And so I, you know, felt another faux pas there because here is, you know, this woman who probably has a lot of beliefs about Western feminists coming and trying to, you know, shut out her worldview, and kind of here I come with a secret poison to poison her in my chocolate. So,
yeah, that could have happened anywhere, though.
Yeah,
that,
well, that just showed me, you know, I mean, you can do so much as a researcher to try and anticipate where your interview subjects are coming from, but in general, I found a lot of graciousness, and I found a lot of openness, and so trying to meet people where they were, a lot of times they made the effort and tried to meet me where I was as well.
I have to ask, too, because this is, taking me back to some of my first interviews when I was a graduate student working on my dissertation. Did the first couple interviews, I don't know, maybe the first week or two that you were there, were you really nervous doing the first interviews?
Well, you know, I kind of had this, you know, do or die mentality because, again, yes, I was a young researcher in my second year of graduate school, and I knew this was a big opportunity, and if I didn't step up to the plate, you know, the stories that really needed to be told were going to pass up. So my first interview was interesting because I picked a woman who just had so much to say, and she invited me to her house. And I intended the interview to be about an hour, but I didn't really want to interrupt her because she, you know, just had all this interesting, you know, commentary. And, you know, I wanted to answer a certain set of questions, but she just went off on all these tangents. So by the time I'd switched a couple tapes, it had been like 2 hours that I'd sat and interviewed. And so in a way, just kind of breaking the ice, realizing there's no way that I can spend my whole time in Kuwait, you know, with 2-hour interviews. I knew I had to be more assertive and just kind of stay on task. And I did learn a lot in my first interview. And they were all different, I have to say, because, again, trying to be prepared for each interview. It was very helpful. One of my dissertation committee members helped me put together a semi-structured, you know, questionnaire so that I would have a baseline with which to compare and create empirical results, which are shown in the book. But oftentimes, you know, they would take the conversation in ways that I just didn't expect. And I try to reflect those in the book also because it does show a number of paradoxes where we might think people whose dress or religious structure is conservative might actually have very progressive approaches and actually helpful ideas.
Yeah, that's one of the things that definitely comes out in your work. And I just had to ask the question about interviewing, though, because I remember when I was young, you start out by interviewing a number of bishops down in Latin America and important government officials. And I'm sitting in these offices going, I'm just a dopey graduate student. Who'd ever want to talk to me, right? And but they do. People do want to talk to you. And your book is filled with a number of fascinating stories and just insights, not only the quantitative work you've done, but also the qualitative work. And I'm going to recommend that everybody take a look at it, and we'll point people in that direction at our website. But we're running out of time, and I wanted you to reflect a little bit on your first experiences with interviewing, because as we were setting up this interview, you had mentioned that you were taking a trip back to Kuwait, and that you were very excited in coming back to talk about this, because you've published the book, but then you went back and you talked to some more people, and now you're back here in the States. What happened in this last research trip? Did you find confirming evidence of things that you've already written about in the book? Did you find some new avenues for research, some things that you didn't expect, some surprises? What's going on there recently?
Yes, absolutely. It was really so valuable, this last trip I just had in Kuwait, because I was invited by my advisors who have taken the reins on this new research center at Kuwait University to study women and women in society, and highlighting usually a little bit of their achievements and critiquing their strategies for moving forward. So it was nice to be invited and be able to contribute to their growing research portfolio in this topic. I did find, you know, just as you come into the airport and you start driving around, the only real outward visible changes, I mean, positively, the buildings are getting taller and the cell phones are getting smarter. So in a way, you know that the essence of Kuwait has not changed, which is, again, some of the things that help enable these women and men to achieve the changes they want within their social structure. So I found little, you know, superficial change, except for positive ways, because Kuwait's positioning itself as an economic center in the region and trying to, again, just progress in terms of its leadership, not just economically, but with education and research. Some of the conclusions that I drew at the end of the book about the power that these women and men activists within their Islamic framework are achieving some of the strategies that I found that they contributed, building bridges across gender, so including men and women together in their activism, tapping into political apathy, raising awareness, and changing conservative mentalities were still very much in effect. So that was interesting. But again, when I did my fieldwork in 2007, the new actors on the scene were women in politics. And while this is still very important, especially with all of the interesting situations and social changes in the rest of the Middle East, I found that the other actors I mention as bridge builders in my book, the young people in Kuwait, are taking center stage. They're actually coming forward and becoming, you know, just even more articulate about the ways that they want to be a solution to whatever's, you know, ailments or obstacles are keeping their society from being a leader and from them being an actual productive part of society. So young people have really stepped up to the plate since the last time I was there. Actually, a lot of women activists I spoke with in 2007 were kind of bemoaning the fact that Kuwaitis were so privileged and they had so many benefits to living in their society that it made them politically apathetic at times. And while there were activists that I spoke with who were clear about the ways that they wanted to contribute, now they're really taking the reins and taking center stage. And a lot of them are approaching the government, the parliamentarians, and even the ruling emir and saying, we want to be a part of the future of this country. We want to use our brains and we want to start our own businesses and we want to address whatever grievances, underemployment or inequalities are happening in the society. And so they're kind of coming to be these next actors poised to reform in their country. And I think that connects with the other things happening in the region.
Oh, you young people, always changing society on us older folks and getting us all confused. I guess that sounds to be a very interesting thing, and we look forward to more of your writing in the future. Just to close off with, though, and one final question here, and I always like to ask this of all my guests, is any final reflections or thoughts upon your own research and for how you've understood the world over the past, you know, 5 or 6 years? Have the interaction and doing the studies that you've done changed the way you think about life here in the United States, your own life, some preconceptions that you've had?
Sure. Well, absolutely. I think the theme that rings truest is that women can be agents of their own social change, and it doesn't matter where you are in the world, and that we can't underestimate the power of religion and worldview for empowering women and change. And I think that women and feminists or scholars of religion and scholars of gender in the U.S. would do well to pay attention to previously marginalized voices, especially those from a religious background, and see what they come up with.
Well, that is a very good challenge for all the scholars out there, as well as the general public, to always be on the lookout for that. And Alessandra, it's been wonderful having you on Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.